So, good morning, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the organizers for the kind invitation. And if I want to follow Steve's joke from yesterday, I thank the organizers for maximizing the enjoyment of the workshop for the second day. So, as a way of disclosure, I serve at the board of Society of the Heart Attack Prevention and Education. One of the technologies that I'll be talking here has been licensed by Boston Scientific, and this work has been funded by the National Science Foundation. So what I would like to share with you today is an overview of the challenges of analyzing cardiovascular data, the results we have obtained using the methods that we have developed, but I will not present the details of the individual algorithms due to the time limitation. So if there is an interest about the specific algorithms, please see me afterwards so we can communicate through email. So I will focus more on presenting the challenges, an overview of our approach, and the results we have obtained so far. At the same time, if you have some ideas based on your own expertise on how we can improve and obtain better results on the problems I'll talk here today, please feel free to contact me. So first I'll talk a little bit about screening for heart disease, and then I'll talk about our work in cardiovascular informatics. So first let me dispel some of the myths concerning cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease is the number one killer in the United States, and if you see the number of deaths, it's about 1 million deaths per year, which is a number greater than the total number of deaths from cancer, accidents, and HIV. So to put it in perspective, about 3,000 individuals will have a heart attack this weekend, and from those, 50% will die, and they will not know what they died from. So we're talking about asymptomatic individuals. And this is where we want to make our mark. We want to be able to predict who is at risk of having a heart attack so we can design early intervention. The second thing I want to point out is that heart disease is a pandemic. So if you ask me, it's the second most important problem in the world after poverty. In my opinion, poverty is the biggest problem, and heart disease is the second biggest problem. So I'll start with showing you a video that illustrates the concepts of who is at risk of having a heart attack. So allow me to play this video.
How is it that an individual can be athletic and active, perhaps running several miles a day, but still suffer a heart attack only the next day? The answer lies in what the following individuals had in common. Former President Clinton, Jim Fix, American icon of marathon runners, and Daryl Kyle, successful Major League Baseball player. All of these people were considered to be vulnerable patients. A vulnerable patient has a 10% or greater risk of having a heart attack in the next 12 months. It is reported that over 1.4 million Americans experience a life-threatening, unpredicted heart attack every year. But by far, the worst aspect of this phenomenon is that for between 50 and 60% of the men and women who die suddenly from coronary heart disease, death from heart attack is the first symptom. But how would you know if you are a vulnerable patient? Today, it is known that the majority of heart attacks are caused not by the gradual narrowing of the arteries, but by structures called plaques, buildups of cholesterol and fatty deposits in isolated areas of the arteries. Though most individuals will live many years with some plaques, the ones of interest are those that have grown unstable, inflamed, and close to rupturing. These are called vulnerable plaques. The challenge lies in locating those plaques that are considered vulnerable and therefore pose an immediate danger to the patient. These vulnerable plaques are inflamed, causing the body's immune system to attack the fat buildup in these plaques as if they are sites of infection. As a result, they are soft and prone to rupture. Upon rupturing, they create a blood clot that suddenly blocks the coronary arteries and causes a heart attack.
Okay. So if you look at the number of deaths in 1990, you will see that the number of deaths was evenly distributed between the developed and the developing world. But it turns out that the estimates for the year 2020 show that 75% of the deaths will be in the developing world. So this is the third myth I would like to dispel, that heart disease is not only a problem of the developed world. So let's see how we can identify the individuals before an event occurs. So current guidelines advocate an office-based assessment, and they look at risk factors that include age, total cholesterol, HDL, blood pressure, so on and so forth. So based on these risk markers, you get a low, either low risk, high risk, or intermediate risk. However, if we look how well we are doing in preventing heart disease, in this study from Tulane University, you can see that between 1971 and 82, and 82 and 92, we're able to do very well in reducing the mortality in half. You can see here, we reduced the mortality in half, but we haven't done any better in stopping heart attack. So we can treat heart attacks, but we have not done anything better in terms of preventing heart attacks. And the problem is that the current risk scoring mechanisms aren't really suitable to find individuals at risk. And I'll give you a very simple example here. One of the risk factors is cholesterol. But if you see the distribution of cholesterol values for people that do have heart disease and people that do not have heart disease, you'll see a lot of overlaps. So just using cholesterol as a way to identify who is at risk definitely is not going to make it. And in general, what happens is the current cardiovascular risk scores put an emphasis on age and the short-term risk rather than the long-term elevated risks. So this way they don't catch the young individuals that are at risk. So clearly, there is a need to change the way we score individuals, and we can follow the classical four P's, correct? What we want to do is we want to be predictive. We want to optimize the identification of persons at the high risk of cardiovascular disease. We want to be preventive, we want to be preemptive, and of course, we want to be personalized. So that means we want to use accurate biomarkers associated with the pathophysiology of a specific individual. So I'm associated with the Society for Education for Heart Attack Prevention and Eradication, and the society has put together a document a few years ago that advocates the need for a national screening program. And here are the specifics of the national screening program. And it basically involves a pyramid of tests going from simple to more, going from less accurate to more accurate, going from less invasive to more invasive, going from inexpensive to expensive. And the idea is you start with some serum markers, and if you are found at risk with respect to this measurement, then you have some imaging, non-invasive imaging like computed tomography and angiography. And then if you are found at risk with respect to this measurement, then you have invasive exams like intravascular ultrasound. Here's the specifics of the test, and you can go over after my talk if you're interested. But it's clearly there is a need for change in the way we score individuals for heart disease. But if this national screening program becomes a reality, it's easy to understand that from the amount of data that we have now, we're going to have large amounts, mainly massive data sets, if I want to use some of the words that were used yesterday here. And if I want to be self-critical of the techniques and methods that we have available today, I believe that we are here, but that's what we need today. So having said that, I would like to share with you some of the approaches and the theoretical framework and the computational tools that we have developed to help the physicians in scoring the patient's vulnerability and the likelihood of a future coronary event. So if I want to summarize what are the causes of heart attack, I will say there are causes related to vulnerable plaque, vulnerable blood, and vulnerable myocardium. So first, and this is an example of myocardium, so I'll show you some of the things that we have done with analysis of MRI data from the heart. So we have developed a completely automatic system that allows you from the exam completely automatically to get the shape of the left ventricle over time. And once you have that, both the epicardial and the endocardial surface, then you can do a number of measurements, a number of descriptors, like the end-systolic volume, end-systolic volume, heart rate, so on and so forth, and also the injection fraction that tells how much blood is your heart pushing, which is an indicator of heart health. So to accomplish that, we have developed methods that basically analyze these MRI slices as a volume, and the result of the analysis is a surface of the left ventricle, the endocardial and the epicardial surface, and we have done a lot of validation studies that basically show you that our accuracy is as good as the accuracy of a manual reader sitting down and taking an hour to analyze these exams. Now, moving into another type of exam, the coronary, the computed tomography angiography exam. Here is an example of an axial slice from a CT exam. And what we are looking at such an exam is this calcified regions. So right now, the physicians have to manually select these calcified lesions and associate with what coronary artery they are associated. What we want to do is we want to develop a method that automatically will compute these calcified plaques and also compute a number of descriptors that we can examine their predictive ability. So the basic rationale stems from the fact that right now, if you undergo a thoracic exam, if it's ordered by a cardiologist, then they will analyze the heart in your data. If it's ordered by a radiologist, they will look at the lungs. Ideally, you would like to have 100 software agents, and each of these software agents to mine this data for different hypotheses, maybe 100 different hypotheses. And if we can do that automatically, and if we can do that fast, then you provide additional quantitative information for the physician to make decisions. And let's remember that, you know, we talk about personalized medicine, but physicians always did personalized medicine, correct? They take information about individual patient in making decisions. So the overall framework from the image analysis point of view for such process is you start with the CT data. We have methods to automatically compute the thoracic cavity, then locate the heart, obtain an anatomical coordinate system associated with the heart. Then we have a model of what are the zones where we expect the different coronary arteries to be, and then we label the calcified plaques accordingly. I want to stress here that we are interested to have methods that are accurate and robust. Because when you want to run this in 25,000 data sets for epidemiological studies, so you need to have a method that is accurate and robust. And based on this, now we have developed a software that will take an exam, automatically score these lesions, and now we can examine different feature descriptors about these lesions. Right now, what happens is that we look at the total number of voxels that are representing calcified plaque, and it's called calcium score. So you and I can have the same calcium score, let's say 10, but this is a total. It doesn't tell us if I have 10 voxels that are one region that is calcified or 10 individual regions that are spread. So we want to be able to extract information, biomarkers associated with these plaques and examine if they will offer additive predictive value in cardiovascular risk scoring. For example, we can examine whether these regions are heterogeneous or homogeneous, if they are scattered, dense, proximal, and distal. I don't have the answers to tell you which of these features, but what we're doing is developing the method that will allow you to go in 25,000 data sets, extract these feature descriptors, and using some of the techniques that we heard here yesterday, find out which are the features that will be important to increase the predictive value of these scoring mechanisms. So let me give you a flavor of the methods that we have developed. The first step is segmenting the thoracic region. So basically what you want to do is from a CT exam like this, obtain a surface of the thoracic cavity, because this delineates the region you want to look. And bear with me as my computer updates. All right, So basically, this is a segmentation problem, finding the optimal surface that will delineate the thoracic cavity from the rib cage, and we have cast it basically as a minimum cost closed set problem. And the details can, as I said, can be found in our IEEE publication. But to give you an idea about the results, we're solving a minimum ST-CAT problem, and we can obtain results like the one here that clearly finds very accurately where is the thoracic area. And this is important because it's inside the thoracic area where we will look to find the heart. So here are some of the results, a lot of validation, about 99% overlap in terms of the dissimilarity coefficient. That's a coefficient that tells us how accurate is our segmentation when compared with a gold standard, which is a technician reading the exam. So the next step is, now that you have delineated the search, is to find automatically where is the heart. So last year in the CVPR conference, we presented a graph-based method for image segmentation. And I will jump in that PowerPoint now. So by the term image segmentation, I will refer to the fact that in every pixel in this image, this non-contrast CT scan, I want to give a label whether this pixel belongs to the heart or not. So this is the result that I want to obtain. But as we all know, image segmentation is an ill-posed problem, so we need to pose additional constraints. And since we are working in a domain where we know what is the object that we are looking to segment, like the heart, it's very natural to incorporate prior knowledge that we have about the anatomy of the heart. For example, in terms of appearance, we know that the heart will have an appearance similar to the appearance of blood and muscle tissues in CT exams. So that's one piece of information. We know that it's going to be inside the inner thoracic cavity, and we know that it's going to be between the lungs. So the challenge is how to take this intuitive knowledge, intuitive prior knowledge, and cast it in a theoretical framework, a single unified framework, in order to be able to solve the segmentation problem. So the approach that we have chosen is basically to formulate the segmentation problem as a maximum a posteriori Markov-Randolph field formulation, and then use a fuzzy theoretic model to incorporate these knowledge-driven constraints. So basically, known in the community that this MAP MRF problem basically reduces to minimizing the Gibbs energy function, which is nothing else but the sum of some first order click potentials and second order click potentials. So the contribution comes on how you formulate these first order click potentials and how you formulate the second order click potentials. So if we want to measure if we want to incorporate information concerning appearance and location, we can do that using the first order click potential, because this term VI measures the cost of assigning a label FI to pixel I, given the previous knowledge that we have about the data, and given the fact that we know what is the prior appearance and what is the location. Have a question, Pan? It's connectivity. It's exactly. It's a graph, and it's called the connectivity. It's the neighborhood of a pixel. Okay. So, and for the connectivity prior, we have some prior information on how we want our pixels to look. We want to have the appearance of muscle and blood in the CT data. So if we use the intuitive understanding that if two regions have about the same appearance and they are spatially connected to each other, then they most likely belong to the same object, we can use the fuzzy connected and small models that have been developed in the literature and incorporate this information. What does this mean? Here's my prior information, then I look at each pixel in the image, how similar it is to this prior information, to this prior appearance. And you can see here, I can find a path of similar pixels that will lead me from pixel P1 to this region, but I cannot do this for P2. And we can quantify and formulate this information using fuzzy connectivity. So here is the terms that you can use in terms of similarity in appearance and the adjacency test. Now, in terms of the location, Again, you want to incorporate information concerning the fact that we are inside the thoracic cavity and between the lungs. Again, what you can do is you can write this as a fuzzy conjunction of other spatial relationships. So you can have that I'm in the left side of one lung, the right side of the other lung, inside the thoracic cavity, so on and so forth. We have developed a formulation that allows you to do the fuzzy conjunction of these relationships to obtain this prior information. Now, what you want to do now in the second order click potential, you want to see the compatibility of labels between adjacent pixels. So this second order term measures the cost of jointly assigning a label Fi to pixel I and a label Fj to pixel j and this a neighboring pixel given the prior information that we have about the data. And this is encoded using the generalized POTS model that says if I have two neighboring pixels and I want to assign the same label, then there is no cost. But if I want to assign different labels, the cost is inversely proportional to the dissimilarity between the feature vectors of these pixels. So that's how we formulate now our energy. Then we have a graph with all these energy terms and we can use the SP minimum cut to find the solution in polynomial time for the binary labeling. Binary label means I have a foreground and a background, means I want to find the heart and the rest of the image is the background. If you want multiple labels, it's an NP-hard problem. There are methods in the literature using alpha expansion that will allow you to find a solution. So if I want to give you some of the results that we have obtained, you can see the different terms and we have very correctly localized where is the heart. Remember, we're doing a multi-resolution. We started with thoracic cavity. We want to find out where is the heart because it's inside this region that we will look for the calcified regions. So this method has the following limitation. Because the heart muscle and the diaphragm and it has similar appearance, then our method will leak in the area of the diaphragm. And you can see it clearly here that we have cases where we have a leak into the organs below the diaphragm. But what we want to do is we want to constrain now the solution using prior shape information. We have a statistical model for the shape of the heart. Can we use it to constrain our solution for the heart segmentation? And that's the topic of this paper that I'll be presenting in a few days in the CVPR conference. And the idea is somebody gives you an image and you have also a statistical shape plate that tells you approximately how the shape looks like. Can you find an accurate result? So again, we'll follow the same formulation. We're going to have a Gibbs energy that we want to minimize using first order and second order click potentials. But in this case, we are going to break this energy into three terms. Energy that comes from appearance, from location, and from shape. And the information about appearance and location, we have seen it earlier. So now I will focus on the constraints imposed by the fact that you have a prior shape. You more or less know how the heart looks like. So in that case, you want to impose constraints that relate to the flux. You want to impose constraints related to the fact that the heart shape is a star shape, and you want to be as close as possible to the template. So what you can do is you can use this template instead of using the template as a contour constraint. You can derive a gradient vector field of the signed distance of this shape template. And once you have that, you can put all your constraints using this gradient vector field. What I mean is that basically you want your segmentation contour to be locally perpendicular to this shape prior vector field. How you can do that? Well, you can maximize the flux, and using the divergence theorem, we can convert this constraint to a first-order click potential. The second thing you want to do is you want to ensure that your shape is a star shape. Okay, so you can convert this star shape constraint into a constraint to the vector field, which means that you want your flow to be positive. So you want penalize any possibility of a negative flow. And then the third thing you want to do is you want to be as close as possible to the potential variations of this safety plate, and you can do that using a distance transform between the template and your segmentation contour. So to put all these things together, I'll start by segmenting the image just using appearance and location. I'm going to introduce my template, then I'm going to see the solution if I want to maximize the flux and enforce the constraint of a star shape, and then I'm going to enforce the third constraint. So I'm imposing the constraints one after the other, and I obtain results like this. So now we are at the point where we have an accurate and robust algorithm that will be able to find in 3D the location where the heart occurs. And this sets the stage, and you can see more results here. So this sets the stage now for finding where are the calcified lesions and to which area they belong to, which coronary area they belong to. Remember, we need to know not only their location, but if they belong to the left coronary artery or the circumflex, and so on and so forth. So what we have done is we have built a model on the regions where we expect the LAD to be, the LCX and the RCA, and based on this learned model, we're going to classify each calcified lesion to which area it belongs. And we have done this using a nonlinear SVM. We have not done any modifications there. We used SVMs as a tool to be able to classify. So one of the things that was imperative in our case to be able to succeed is that we have a coordinate system that is aligned with the heart. And this is different from individual to individual. So this allows us to put all the training data in the same coordinate system and have successful training. So the output of this method now is that I can find automatically the calcified plaques. I can tell you in which coronary artery they belong to, because we know that, for example, the calcified lesions in the LAD are more dangerous than the calcified lesions in LCX. But also we want to know the distance from the root of the artery, because we know, again, from knowledge that the first 5 millimeters of the LAD is the so-called widow maker. This is where this is the most dangerous location to have a calcified plaque. So we want to be able to quantify this information, quantify the distance of a plaque from the root of the coronary artery. And you can see here that there is still some work in accomplishing our results. We are about 89% the best case. So there is more work to be done to increase the robustness and accuracy of detecting these calcified plaques. There is a lot of noise in these CT exams and a lot of imaging artifacts that poses challenges in this. Another risk marker that we want to obtain from the CT data is the amount of fat, and here is our work that we have developed for quantifying abdominal fat. And of course, you may say the abdominal fat is correlated with the size of your belt, so what's the value of doing it using an imaging exam? But then the argument is one of the most important risk factors has emerged in the literature is the pericardial fat, the amount of fat around your heart, and this does not correlate with your weight. So we want to have methods to be able to quantify the pericardial fat, because this is an additional risk factor that we would like to include on our cardiovascular risk score. So now that we have the tools to automatically extract these biomarkers, we can do large epidemiological studies and test different hypotheses. For example, in this case, we have run studies with 3,000 individuals, and we found something that was not known in the literature before. For example, that an increase in the abdominal fat for women has a 2 times stronger impact on their risk rather than men. So you can see the sex difference on the impact of these cardiovascular risk factors. In addition, we are able to quantify the motion of the coronary arteries, and we can parameterize this motion and come up with the blades like this that break up the individual components of motion. So here is the radial displacement along the length of the artery, along the length of the artery, and then different during the different cardiac phases, from end systole to end diastole. So for us, these are signatures, and the hypothesis is that analyzing signatures like this, you will be able to discriminate between healthy and diseased arteries. Again, this is the hypothesis. We have the computational tools in place. Maybe in the next workshop in 2 years, I'll report on what are the results and whether these templates are indeed discriminative, offer discriminative power. Now, moving into the third tier of the pyramid, I talked to you about non-invasive imaging. Now I'm moving in the third tier of the imaging, where it's basically putting an ultrasound catheter inside your arteries. So up to a few years ago, using this ultrasound catheter, they could see clearly the different tissues. They could see where is the lumen, where is intima, media, but there was no functional information. So there was a lot of activity in the literature trying to tease additional information. Morphology was there, but they wanted to be able to characterize tissues. That's, there is a famous work by Volcano in virtual histology. The idea is trying to map each pixel to the individual tissue, where it's fat, calcium, blood, so on and so forth. There was work on measuring the temperature of the plaques. There is work on spectroscopy, palpography, so on and so forth. The method and the area that we introduced in the field is the so-called vasovasorum imaging. Vasovasorum imaging is the imaging of the neovessels that are created as a result of plaque inflammation. So using the techniques that we have developed now, not only we can see morphology, but we can see function, we can see inflammation. So basically, vasovasorum are the vessels that are feeding the vessel wall. And in the case of atherosclerosis, then you can see that this density changes. And we want to be able to change this change of, to measure this change in density. And you can see here an electron microscopy image from this vasovasorum, and this is a cut from histology where you can see the cross sections of these neovessels. And to give you an insight in terms of the pathophysiology of this, so it turns out that oxygen diffusion is adequate for about 40 cell layers in the normal artery. So any structure that is thicker than that, any plaque that is thicker than about 400 micrometers, you need to have active blood transport. You need to have transport of nutrients. So for a plaque to grow several millimeters in thickness, then promotes the generation of new vessels that will be the conduits to transfer the nutrients. So these new vessels are fragile, and they promote intraplaque hemorrhage that can destabilize a plaque. So the fundamental insight here is that if you have large inflamed plaques, then you have large vasovasorum density, but if you have old fibrocalcified plaques, you have the least density. So what we have done is to take advantage of this fact to measure not only disease progression. Here is the image of normal vasovasorum, and this is the vasovasorum after high cholesterol diet, but also measure regression as the effect of therapy. Because if we can measure vasovasorum density and correlate it with the effects of the therapy, we can measure disease regression. So we wanted to be able to, yes. So this is because we have a volume and we are taking a cut of the volume. This is a visualization effect, not physiology. Thanks for pointing this out. So the problem is, suppose that we have neovessels, can we find them in vivo? And what we have done is we have developed a method that allows us to do exactly this. So allow me to play a video that summarizes this method.
Groups of researchers at the Computational Biomedicine Laboratory at the University of Houston, the University of Athens, Columbia University, and Aarhus University, in collaboration with the Association for Eradication of Heart Attack, have developed a new technique for detection of vulnerable plaques called vasovasorum imaging. Vasa vasorum are networks of microvessels that feed the walls of arteries. Research suggests that a greater proliferation of vasa vasorum in a plaque is a clear indicator of plaque inflammation and vulnerability to rupture. The group is at work perfecting a technology that aims to effectively and safely pinpoint the location of vulnerable plaques, and more importantly, a system that will measure and quantify the vulnerability of each plaque. Researchers in the Computational Biomedicine Laboratory are in charge of developing the algorithms and software for analyzing the imaging data. The Screening for Heart Attack Prevention and Education Task Force, or the SHAPE Task Force, of the Association for the Eradication of Heart Attack, suggests a new non-invasive screening process that identifies high-risk individuals. However, identification of vulnerable plaques is pending on the success of the new invasive techniques. The new vasa vasorum screening technique uses a technology known as intravascular ultrasound. Intravascular ultrasound is a safe, widely used technology which provides detailed views of the interior of human blood vessels. The process works in several steps. An ultrasound catheter is placed in a vessel of interest, usually one close to a suspicious plaque area in an artery. Gas-filled nanobubbles are then injected into the vessels and absorbed by the vasa vasorum, illuminating them under ultrasound so that they can be analyzed by a physician. If extensive vasa vasorum growth is detected, this could be an indicator of plaque vulnerability. Using vasa vasorum imaging developed by the University of Houston and its collaborators, doctors will be better equipped to locate vulnerable plaques before they have an opportunity to rupture and cause a heart attack.
Okay, so this video gave you a small idea of what we are doing. And basically, the way the protocol works, you inject these nanobubbles, and here is the image before the injection, here is the image during the injection, because these nanobubbles block the signal of the intravascular ultrasound, and here is the image afterwards. And if I can draw your attention in this area of the video, you will see that initially looks black, but then it becomes gray because the nanobubbles enter the vasa vasorum and give us response. So I will play this video and okay. So keep your eyes here, now in injection. You can see clearly here that we have the appearance of these new vessels. So we have developed software that analyzes these images, and the principle is very simple. You have an image before and an image after, you subtract them and you quantify the change. Well, everything would be simple if there was no movement, correct? Because in essence what we are doing is your measurements come from different planes as the catheter moves with respect to the heart, with respect to the artery, and you have also artifacts because of breathing. So the first thing you want to do is you want to get your image sequence and find out which images are related to this section of the artery that you are interested to image. So one of the things that we had developed is image-based frame gating. ECG is not going to work there because it doesn't give you the information of the location of the catheter with respect to the artery. You have to infer that. And to show you an example, look here, the beating of the artery with respect to the vessel wall, because we're going in and out from the imaging plane. Now, using our techniques, we're able to select which frames from this big image sequence come from the same image area, and you can see here that there is no beating in this area. How we accomplish this? Basically, what we have done is we have taken all the frames, we built a dissimilarity matrix, and then we did the MDS transformation to give us the clusters of the individual frames. Now that you have the clusters, we can go in and find where is the lumen completely automatically, and another image segmentation technique. We can do the difference imaging, apply noise reduction techniques, threshold, and then you can get these areas that basically tell to the clinician during surgery which arteries are vulnerable and which are not, because all of us have a lot, excuse me, which plaques are vulnerable and which are not, because all of us have a number of plaques, and if we were to put stent in every plaque, then we'll be the bionic men and women. So the physician needs to decide which plaques to stent and which ones not to stent. And we can have perfusion curves, and we have studies in the University of Athens in Greece that show some very remarkable results in terms of being able to identify which plaques are vulnerable and intervene in time. And also we have validation studies in place. So here is a histology of a plaque, and in red here we have a manual annotation of the areas where we have these neovessels. And if I want to blow up this, you will see that this is what histology gives, this is what software gives. This is very promising direction for our future work. Right now I talked about the introduction of a contrast agent. But the question is, this requires an injection. Can we do the same thing if we use the blood as a contrast agent? Imagine that you have an aerial photograph, correct? And you want to find where are the roads. Well, that's a very difficult problem because there are a lot of distractions. But you can change the problem if you say, okay, if I assume that the cars are moving on the roads, which is not true in Texas, but it's true in other states, and if I can find where the cars are moving, then I can find where are the roads. So similarly, if we can find where the red blood cells are moving, then we can find where we have these neovessels, and that's the current topic of our work. So in the past 40 minutes, I have shown you what are the challenges in analyzing cardiovascular data, and our contributions come from analyzing these images or volumes from different imaging modalities to extract quantitative information that can be further used by the physician in arriving in a new cardiovascular risk score. And at this point, I'll acknowledge the different agencies funding our work, and I'll take your questions.